Well, boy, isn't that the perfect metaphor for what we're talking about in so many ways. Goldfinger. And yes, so the pursuit of power, the desire to be able to turn anything into gold, to control the world through controlling the economy or through, in some cases here, we're learning about in the book, The Philosopher's Stone, is both the dark side and the light side of this kind of alchemy or modern physics. You decide. We'll get to your calls, your questions for Joseph Farrell last hour here on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Let's start our questions and comments for Joseph Farrell, who is one of, but perhaps the best of the researchers into Nazi scientific research, especially sort of the highly classified kind. Don is in Oregon on Coast to Coast AM for Joseph Farrell. Don?
Hi, guys. And boy, Neil, you know, you're on my you-know-what list. I was waiting to talk to Neil last night, and the wife pulled me up to do some kind of chore, so I had to hang up.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry about that. But it was a really good show, so I'm sorry you couldn't get through.
It was just outstanding.
Okay.
Joseph, I followed all this stuff, and I'm right there with you, bud. I want to know, because I believe the government knows about alchemy, the physics, all that good, happy stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, if we have that power, why are we rolling over to the rest of the world instead of standing up for America and not doing anything about it? And I'll listen off the air. And thanks, guys.
Okay.
Excellent question, Don, and it raises a lot of issues. And I think the premier issue that it raises is, does our government indeed have control over its own black projects? And the reason I state it that way is because it's a historical fact, and I think documented rather well through my own research and the research of others in the field, that when we made the deal with the devil at the end of World War II and brought over a bunch of these paperclip Nazis, if you dig long and hard enough, you'll discover that one of our almost persistent security concerns with these people was that they seemed to have left in place a sort of interior chain of command among them. In other words, they were kind of pursuing their own things inside of our own black projects and kind of using our own security compartmentalization of those projects against us. So, you know, the question then becomes, well, how much control do we really have over this? And my intuition, and I stress it's only an intuition, is that we might not have as much control over some of this stuff as we think we do.
Interesting thought. And then it's also assuming that we actually have it, which or that anybody has it. But but why not, when you actually consider how much was known? And you can read more about it in the book, The Philosopher's Stone. Art is in Joshua Tree, California, on Coast to Coast. Art?
Hi there. I'm here. What I would like to ask and talk about, if I may, is the whole relation of alchemy to the search for immortality.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the alchemists, I've done considerable reading in this, were attempting to do transmutations to get a life energy that they believe was present in the mineral kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And that then there was a second stage of processing this life energy into a medicine that would give long life.
Mm-hmm.
And you barely mentioned that aspect of it.
Well, I do mention it at much greater length in the book, Art, but it is a fair insight. And your insight here, I think, goes directly to some of the aspects of the claimed properties for the Philosopher's Stones, one of them being precisely longevity and the other being healing. Now, it's interesting that I found in my research a series of physics papers that related some of this high-spin state physics to the ability of the ordinary DNA helix itself to have sort of semi-superconductive electrical properties in normal room temperature. So in other words, there is a certain degree of biophysics that's even tying in with some of this alchemical research. But yeah, I take your point, and it's an excellent one. That certainly was a preoccupation of the alchemists.
Well, and that would be an interesting way of understanding what they thought might be their responsibility,
right,
in that the alchemists would be alive to continue to oversee what they were able to create.
Yes, exactly so.
They wouldn't have to hand it off generationally.
Right.
If they were right, then they could, then they themselves would stay in charge of their project for an undetermined amount of time. Douglas is in San Francisco on a wild card line. We actually have a couple of wild card lines open. Douglas, here's your chance to talk with Joseph Farrell.
And that chance is appreciated, Mr. Punnett, and I hope you're both doing well.
Oh, thank you, Douglas.
Thanks so much, Mr. Farrell. I think you're really performing a service to the public by helping to introduce them to so many historical paradigms that have been hidden away by a lot of document destruction, which, as Mr. Punnett knows, I used to participate in at the Presidio Military Base. I definitely want to confirm your stance on the coaxial development of the atomic bomb. I mean, certainly before the end of the war, the Commander-in-Chief of the Atlantic of the United States put out a tremendous submarine hunt over four advanced U-boats that were deployed to hit the East Coast with atomic bombs that were to be launched on V-2 rockets.
Yes.
And so this operation was a success, but the Nazi regime had made its point. And so the comparison that's most important ideologically to what you're putting out in the Nazi International and whatnot is that the Third Reich was not really comparable to the Napoleonic Wars on the sense that they were based on the dynamism of a singular personality like Adolf Hitler, but it's more akin to the Hundred Years' War, where we have quiescent interregnums punctuating a continuum of ideological struggle.
All right. Douglas, let's give Joseph a chance in there. Go ahead, Joseph.
Well, Douglas, I do know about those U-boat operations, and you're quite right that those operations did occur. And I do get into some unusual U-boat operations in the Nazi International, but you're absolutely right that the Nazi Party really is kind of, to use Peter Lavenda's phrase, kind of a religious cult, and Hitler's just the one in charge of it at the time. So, yeah, I think your point is well made.
Let's go to John in Idaho on Coast to Coast AM, first-time caller line for Joseph Farrell. Go ahead, John.
Hello, Ian. Nice to speak with you. And, Joseph, I have a question. There's a theory that's been put forth by some that the global elite, the end of World War II, wanted to extend the war so that we could use the atomic bomb on Japan, so that people worldwide would see the result and be afraid of it, and thus enter in the nuclear age.
Right.
I'll take your comment off the air.
Well, I'm familiar with the theory, and I think that there is a bit of merit to it. If you examine some of the things that were going on in the discussions within Truman's cabinet and his administration. So I think that there is a bit of merit to it. One of the things that I've uncovered in my research is that the stocks of fissile U-235 that would have been available to the Manhattan Project, according to some of its own project records, would not have been sufficient for a bomb until November. But within about 2 weeks after the surrender of a particular German U-boat that's carrying a bunch of fissile U-235 to Japan, after that U-boat surrenders to this country, our supply of U-235 miraculously doubles. So I think, there's a hidden agenda taking place at the end of the war.
The book is The Philosopher's Stone, Alchemy and the Secret Research for Exotic Matter. And it's that key part, the exotic matter piece, that keeps drawing people into this conversation. And if you've missed it, if you're just tuning in, go back and streamlink and catch the earlier explanations, or go online and link up to Joseph Farrell's work at coasttocoastam.com. Worth looking into because of the implications of what exotic matter might actually be able to do for us still, and the bullet we dodged, perhaps, in World War II. Joe is in Arizona on Coast to Coast. Joe?
Hey, how's it going? This is Joe. I'm from the Pima Indian Reservation, and I just had a question about the relationship between the Pima and the German people. So there was a particular area in reference to the swastika.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It was actually placed on in the it had a different meaning, but the same exact replica of the German swastika.
Right. Well, that's another interesting question. It's not one that I have yet gotten into in any of my books, but I do know about a lot of these North American and South American and Mesoamerican Indian legends. And one of the persisting things that is very, very unusual is that you'll find, Joe, particularly in Aztec and Mayan legend, references to these bearded white men that came from across the sea and taught them civilization. And there's been a body of research very recently, actually, that's appeared by my Polish friend Igor Witkowski that indicates that there was also a certain migration or emigration of peoples from Asia across the Pacific to this part of the world. And again, you find very interesting symbolic connection, uses of Hindu symbols in South
right.
America and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I do think that there is some sort of connection way, way back in prehistory. And there's a final little interesting piece of news that geneticists have recently come onto, and that is that within the mitochondrial DNA within some North American Indian nations, you find the same mitochondrial DNA type as you find in white Europeans, which is, you know, is yet another wrench in the, you know, the old standard Bering Strait theory. So
right.
We really are on the cusp, I think, of trying to reconstruct a lot of this prehistory.
You know, I've heard it argued that the universality of the swastika is due to its simplicity, and that it actually makes a handy sort of primal representation of the sun or of the life force, which so many people were looking at. That sort of almost the kinetic energy of the swastika always appearing to be in motion, always rolling, always boiling, or
right.
however you want to see it. And I think that it's fair to point out that that is one of the, it's like a circle or it's like a cross. I mean, it can grow pretty any place where people are drawing symbols. They might have stumbled across the swastika. It's not that unique.
Well, it's not that unique, and I think you're right that it's an ideogram of this kind of physics that we've been talking about all night. In fact, it's almost a perfect kind of simplified ideogram of what we've been talking about.
I want to bring up something my friend Alice had emailed me about before the show started. I know nothing about this, so stop me anytime you either want to comment or don't.
Sure.
But she was particularly interested in another German, Victor Schauberger.
Is that name?
Who was I guess he was Austrian, but he was a naturalist and a philosopher, and that he was working on water engines. Are you familiar with his work?
Yes, I certainly am. In fact, I go into it at a bit of length in my first book in this series called Reich of the Black Sun.
Oh, interesting.
But he's exactly right, and you're exactly right. He was a naturalist, and he kind of coined his own kind of physics language to explain what he was dealing with. But again, if you boil it all down to brass tacks, Ian, what he's really dealing with in all of his experiments and his devices is precisely, again, this idea of high-spin rotational physics. He even invented this kind of very bizarre kind of bladeless turbine based on some of these ideas for the Nazis. He did work for them under duress during the war.
And then later is captured by the Americans, too?
Well, that's another interesting story. He isn't captured by us, but he's brought over here to this country. I recount the episode in Reich of the Black Sun. And he's taken to Sherman, Texas, of all places, by this American millionaire who wants to use his ideas to create anti-gravity. And Schauberger and his son were basically kind of kept under lock and key until Schauberger eventually turned over all the rights to his devices and his ideas to this American millionaire. And then you never hear about Schauberger's ideas again until very, very recently.
Huh. Very interesting.
Yep.
Well, such is the research of Joseph Farrell. David is in Phoenix on Coast to Coast AM. David? David's got the radio on in the background, so I'll put you on hold and go ahead and get that off, and I will come back for you in another call. First, Eric is in Bakersfield on Coast to Coast. Eric?
Yes, Mr. Farrell, can you tell me what eventually became of Saint Germain? And if you have time for it, please describe the Emerald Tablet.
Okay, well, Saint Germain I don't get into, but the legend is that he was one of these alchemists who, in fact, lived a very, very long life. In fact, you find legends about him popping up in European courts in the Renaissance. You find him during the period of the Thirty Years' War. You find him later during the Enlightenment and so on and so forth. This was a very long-lived guy, if you accept the documents at face value. But again, I think, you know, this goes to the whole idea of the Philosopher's Stone conferring longevity. As for the Emerald Tablets, what those are the reputed tablets of the Egyptian wisdom god Tahuta. And they supposedly contain, they do actually have an existing text that kind of sums up the alchemical philosophy with the phrase, as above, so below. And basically, these are considered by alchemists to be kind of the central distillation of their art.
The belief in Saint Germain was that, at least one of the legends, is that he was able to continue a long life, not just because he then broke the code for longevity, but also because he was able to turn basic elements into gold, which kept fueling his status in the aristocracy,
right,
no matter what era he was in.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, he was able to keep buying privilege. Let's go to Mike in Oregon, then we'll get back to David in Phoenix. Go ahead, Mike.
I was calling to see what Joseph's opinion was of how the Nazis fit in with the international sort of power structure or control mechanism.
Oh,
I feel it has to do with, you know, going back to an old term for Catholicism, the Church of Rome. And then we have the Rothschilds, who were their bankers. I don't know what their capacity is now or how they work with them. But how do you see the Nazis or the technological sort of occultists fitting in with that? And then...
That's probably all we're going to have time for here, but go ahead. Joseph, if you've got an answer to that, go ahead.
Well, it's an answer. I might have to continue after the break, but basically the idea that you raise here is a very, very good one. If we go back to the founding of the Bilderberg Group for a moment, I believe that the purpose of it is revealed by two of its very early attendees, and the first, of course, would be Prince Bernhard. Many people don't know that Prince Bernhard was an SS officer, and he was also a vice president of IG Farben. So, in other words, if we assume the existence of a post-war kind of Nazi extraterritorial state under the control of people, you know, like Martin Bormann and so on and so forth, then Prince Bernhard is certainly going to still be beholden to them in that chain of command. And I'll continue my answer on the other side of the break, it sounds like.
Well, you got 30, 40 seconds.
Okay.
Do you want to just give it a whack at it and then move on, or if you need more, take it?
But... Well, I'll probably need a little bit more time, I think, because he raises a very good question.
Okay, well, that leaves me 40 seconds of tap dancing.
Okay,
so,
well, okay.
I'll do. I'm that talented. I can put on my dancing shoes, but I just thought I'd rather fill it with your content than mine. But, well, fair enough. Well, we'll leave it there. David, keep your radio off, and you'll be first up then after we come back from the break. And everybody else, hang on. If you're on hold, we will get to you. It's a series of books, but the new one is The Philosopher's Stone, and in particular this long exposition on exotic matter. Just fascinating. You can link up to Joseph Farrell through coasttocoastam.com, and we'll get back to your questions and comments in our last half hour next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Ken, there, last half hour with Joseph Farrell. Love this show. And also one, if you're just coming into it now, you want to go back and listen to on Streamlink when you get a chance. So many things coming in and tying in together. And Joseph's got to tie up one thing that we just got to before the bottom of the hour, before we get to our last round of calls next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so your last question that you wrote down, you stopped halfway through there, sure. And I just want to make sure we get that all in. Joseph?
Well, I was talking about the true founding purposes of the Bilderberg Group, in my opinion, and I mentioned Prince Bernhard being an SS officer and then a vice president of IG Farben. Well, one of the other early attendees at those very early Bilderberg meetings was precisely Dr. Hermann Josef Abs, who was the chairman and CEO of Deutsche Bank, of course, a very large German bank. And that, to me, kind of tells me something about what may have been going on, the real purpose of them at the beginning, and that was all of that cash that the Nazis had after the war, and I do believe that they had an extraterritorial state and had their hands on a lot of cash. Well, it had to go somewhere. They had to have access or outlet or ability to make that cash become clean money, so to speak.
Right.
And the way to do that would have been through those very large banking houses in London and New York that you also see represented at those early Bilderberg meetings.
And Switzerland, too. Because now we know, I mean, for a fact that a lot of that money was getting laundered through Switzerland.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, I take the point that, you know, the purpose here is for laundering that money and then turning it back into Europe so that they can create this European Economic Union. Now, the difficulty is, in my opinion, that if you allow for the existence of the extraterritorial Nazi state, then that money is going to not only expand the off-the-books ledger credit entry-making ability that Western bankers have, but it's also going to come with a very high price tag and a very high marker. It's going to come due someday, and those bankers are going to have to give it back. So I think there may be a little element of some real honest-to-goodness knockdown, drag-out factional infighting that's taking place right now during this current financial crisis. I think the Western bankers are genuinely panicked for a variety of reasons, but one of them, I think, is that someone has the gun to their head, quite literally.
Huh, that's a very interesting idea. David is in Phoenix on Coast to Coast AM. David?
Hi.
Hi, you're talking with Joseph Farrell. Go ahead.
Good to talk to you, Ian and Joseph. I want to go back a ways, probably an hour or so in the program, to where we were talking about, or where you were talking about, the spin of a thorium nucleus and the concept of being like an ice skater.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when we're talking about particle spin, I haven't thought of it a lot in terms of inertia, but are we talking about centrifugal force here?
Well, yes and no. The first thing we have to remember with isomers, the spin that we're talking about is the spin of the nucleus. So you're talking about the spin of all those neutrons and protons that compose any particular nucleus. And it's the nucleus itself that is spinning in this very, very high state of rotation and that's assuming these very, very odd shapes as a result of it, and that it can also spontaneously fission, as they've recently discovered. So that's really what we're talking about. The other thing I did not mention in respect to thorium-229 is that there has been a physics paper recently, although some scientists contest its contents, that they have discovered minute trace amounts of the super heavy element, unbibium, element 122, present naturally in its high isomeric state with a half-life of millions of years in, you know, one part in per quadrillion of thorium. So there's all sorts of ramifications to this. I hope I've answered your question adequately, David.
Jennifer is in Columbus, Ohio on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell. Jennifer?
Oh, hi, guys. Okay, really quickly, this is a fascinating, absolutely fascinating topic, and I'm ashamed to say I haven't read any of your books. I will rectify that situation immediately.
Thank you.
He needs you to buy 2,000 of them to make rent.
I'll work on it.
Okay, because he lives in a very nice place, apparently. So,
okay, so what I want to tell you is my father, beginning in 1960, worked for NCR as a chemist.
Okay.
And he worked with paperclip Nazis.
Right.
Many of them.
Right.
And I know that what you are saying is absolutely true, because I know from talking to my father that, and I too am a student of chemistry, and I know that technology just simply disappeared.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just simply went away.
Yeah.
And, you know, whole departments were working on certain pieces and parts of something that they knew belonged to a larger picture.
Right.
And then, you know, one day, poof, it's gone.
Gone.
And they're on to the next thing.
Well, it's an interesting insight, Jennifer, and I appreciate your sharing that. And there's one thing that, you know, I kind of want to reemphasize and reestablish, kind of confirm what you've said, that in taking these paperclip Nazis, we really were making the bargain with the devil, because there is evidence from not only this country, but from France, from Canada, for other countries that took these Nazi scientists in, that there was some sort of intact internal chain of command that they were still all beholden to.
Kind of an Odessa organization-like group.
Yes, exactly so. Exactly so. And, you know, this fact alone tells us that they are really kind of making the taxpayer of those respective countries foot the bill for their own research projects. And again, I thank you for sharing that information, because it just kind of confirms everything else I've been finding.
And yet those Nazis very much wanted to go to the West as opposed to getting captured by the Soviets.
Well, that is true in most of the cases that you know, we know about. But, my research has uncovered quite a few cases where there were significant Nazi scientists that actually preferred to go to the Soviet Union. In fact, one of their top atomic scientists, a fellow by the name of Baron Manfred von Ardena, actually went to the Soviet Union and worked on their A-bomb project. And he was the only non-Russian ever to win the Stalin Prize for science, kind of the Soviet Union's version of the Nobel Prize.
Right.
So he was instrumental in giving them their A-bomb and some of their separation technology. And, you know, just to kind of comment a little bit further, if I may, on that subject, one of the things that I outline in my books, Ian, is it appears to me that you can make a very solid case that towards the end of the war, the Nazis deliberately begin driving the technology that they want each side to get. So, in other words, let's look at the rockets. We get the creme de la creme of Nazi Germany's rocket scientists. We get Arthur Rudolph, we get Hermann Oberth, we get Werner von Braun, and so on and so forth. But the Soviets get the middle echelon management people that allow them to reconstruct the documents. So you find this kind of stalemated division of the spoils, but the bell, things like that, they keep to their own independent Nazi hands after the war. And that's another interesting aspect of the story.
In South America.
Yeah.
Right. It's very intriguing and shows obviously quite a bit of foresight and intent on their own end game.
Yes, but, absolutely.
Which they saw themselves to a degree in control of. They couldn't anticipate for sure whether or not they might be lined up and shot,
right,
but they could maximize their chances of survival by making themselves very valuable pawns.
Exactly.
Right. Let's get to Tom in Toronto on Coast to Coast AM for Joseph Farrell. Tom?
Oh, thank you. Joseph, my question for you is that I believe that, is it true that the United States, since it's got technology that would be able to use the energy resources that doesn't need any fossil fuel or to control the world economy by using low-tech, the world can use the fossil fuel and other low-cheap source of energy?
Well, that's another excellent question, Tom, and I think in answer to it, to kind of give a short answer, the United States probably is in possession of some elements of it, okay? I think that there are definitely other countries that are players and have possession of it as well, Russia being one of them. I certainly think Germany does. I think China probably has aspects of it, Japan, and so on and so forth. In other words, the typical players.
Right.
The real problem is, again, what they're doing with it. And the downside is that I think that the U.S., Germany, Russia, and these countries are really pursuing full tilt, a kind of a weaponization application of some of it.
In the time that we have, I think we can get at least three more callers on. So let's go to Gene in California on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell. Gene?
This is Gene.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Joseph and Ian, I've got a question, a couple of questions and information for you on Juan Perón.
Well, let's see how much time we have. So go ahead with your best question first.
Best question first is on the periodic table of the elements. You probably are familiar if you had a class in chemistry of the big table on the wall.
Right.
And the elements are all organized by weight.
Right.
Gases on top, heavy metals at the bottom. And from left to right, it's by chemical reactivity.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if, Joseph, if you have had any experience in making a revision of the periodic table of the elements?
Oh, boy, that's an excellent question, Gene. No, I haven't. However, one of the Nazi scientists that was a close associate with Dr. Walter Gerlach, who was the project head for this Bell device, was a student of his, and his name is Dr. Ott Christian Hilgenberg. And Hilgenberg published these enormously abstruse scientific papers right before the war inside of Germany. One of them is a real tongue-twister. I don't even remember the title right off the top of my head in German. But what he did was he reconstructed the entire periodic table on the basis of a vortex model of the atom, okay?
Okay.
And what he did was he also predicted and even gave diagrams of the kind of hexagonal ring structure that he believed the elements involved, and he predicted the structures of the super heavy transuranic elements, you know, and this is from a guy working and writing in 1938 and 1939. So,
beyond the 92 elements of the table.
Oh, yes, absolutely, way, way beyond. One of his diagrams, I reproduce it in Reich of the Black Sun, or pardon me, in SS Brotherhood of the Bell, is actually a diagram of element 118. So, you know, these guys are way ahead of the curve for their period.
And we've got a few blank places in our periodic table, I guess you've noticed.
Right, yes, that's right.
I've got a selection of tables that I got from my father. I found them after he passed away. And he's got several groupings of the elements that I thought was unique.
Uh-huh.
Rather than going the way they are, he's got them in a more logical grouping.
Yeah.
I don't know when that periodic table was made, but it must be at least 1800s. It was when it came out.
Well, the man that came up with it was Dmitri Mendeleev. Okay, and
way back.
Right, way back. But Hilgenberg's reconstruction of the periodic table is very, very different than Mendeleev's. And if you get into some of his reasons for what he's doing, they're actually again based on all this idea of high speed rotational physics.
Derek, first-time caller line in Houston on Coast to Coast AM for Joseph Farrell. Derek?
Yes, this is Derek. I have a question for Joseph. As in regards to you made several statements earlier concerning longevity. I'm a practitioner of Qigong. I've been practicing Qigong for probably 10 years. And part of my training involves the use of magnetic energy, neodymium, rare earth magnets, North Pole, and what this does is it alkalines the body, putting it in more higher, you know, changing the pH level of the water in the body. You know, the blood is 90% water, the brain has water, the bone is 22% water, so on and so forth. Overall, the body is 75% water. Do you have any information or concerning that relationship using magnetic energy or magnetism?
Right.
And longevity, how it relates. The reason why I mention that is because the Yellow Emperor of China, and about 4,000 years ago, wrote in his treatise on internal medicine, he talked about the lodestone, because you talked about the philosopher's stone.
Right, right.
And that the lodestone is a highly, you know, magnetized rock.
Okay, right? let's get the answer, Derek, because I think Joseph was ready to jump in there. So go ahead.
Well, yeah, Derek, there is information about this on the Internet. There's a lot of information about the stuff that the Soviets were doing as well. But the place that I would advise you to start in reference to this kind of magnetic medicine would be with a French physician in the 1960s by the name of Alain Prioré, and that's spelled P-R-I-O-R-E.
O-R-E with one of those little dashes on top of the E, okay?
Right.
He did a great deal of medical experimentation in France using precisely the idea of magnetic fields and resonance as a healing tool. And, of course, the French medical pharmacological establishment suppressed him just like they've suppressed any other attempt to do this kind of medicine. But that's the place to start, and it'll lead you to some very interesting other places.
Well, you know, let me just say, you've taken us into some very interesting places. I never would have anticipated you would have been able to address so many of these esoteric questions. So I'm very impressed, and
oh,
even more
you.
So than I was in where we started, which was in awe of what you were able to get just into the philosopher's stone. Last caller, though, is going to have to come from Jan on Coast to Coast from Brooklyn. Go ahead, Jan.
I'll do it quickly.
Thank you.
I heard about white gold, that it's very, you talked about the white powder.
Yes.
And that it's really great. I heard it's really great for you to take and very healthy. Do you know about it? Do you know where to get it?
There are a number of places that do give or do produce monatomic gold. You can kind of find them on the internet if you Google search for monatomic gold. And I have not taken it myself in any great degree. However, I have done so, and I do note that it for some reason kind of quiets you down, and at the same time it sharpens your thinking.
Huh.
So, it's a very peculiar kind of response that you get to this stuff. You know, I thought about these claims, and I thought, well, I might as well try it and see if they're true. And
right.
In my own personal experience, they do have some sort of effect on you. I don't know if I would go so far as to believe all the claims that are out there for it. But, yeah, you can find this stuff very easily on the Internet.
Very good. Well, thank you. And I don't know if you could tell. I mean, did you grow up any place where there's a lot of snow?
Oh, yes. I grew up in South Dakota, so
okay,
I'm a neighbor of yours.
All right. So you know that, like, you know, a popular pastime during the winter months is for kids to grab onto the back bumper of cars.
Yep.
and what we used to call skitching down the street,
yep.
Right? Okay. About 20 times during the course of this conversation tonight, I felt like I've been skitching on the back of the on this very, very, very intriguing conversation you're having with other people. And I just feel like I've been hanging on for dear life, but I really, really enjoyed it. I have to go back and re-listen to this and jot down some notes. And thank you so much. And please log on to coasttocoastam.com and go to Joseph's webpage and buy some of these books, because you're just going to love them. And I know it'll be like another 8 weeks and you'll have another book out, too.
Well, maybe.
good luck with this research, and let's reconvene at some point in the future on it, too. Okay?
It'd be my pleasure. I enjoyed it, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Joseph Farrell. In the meantime, everybody, we'll be back next Saturday night, and I'll be live in L.A. hanging with George Norrie. Deus te amat, and I do too.